Welcome to this episode of Live from Lord North Street. My name's Mark Littlewood. I'm the Director General of the Institute of Economic Affairs, and I'm joined today by the IEA's new Academic and Research Director, Saeed Kamal. Saeed, welcome to the podcast and welcome to the Institute of Economic Affairs.
Well, thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
And you've been here now, a couple of weeks, I think, isn't it? So your feet are well and truly under the desk. So it's great to have you as a part of the IEA family. But I want to talk to you about why free marketeers have been doing so badly in the argument over recent years, or indeed whether we've been doing badly. What's your impression of it? My sense is that I've now been here nearly a decade, that whilst the IEA itself is in rude health and growing and increasing in publicity, in terms of actually shifting the Overton window that we actually often talk about, or winning in terms of public engagement, I'm not sure how successful we have been. I think that free markets, capitalism, scepticism of state intervention, these sort of beliefs and memes seem weaker than they have done for a long time. Do you agree?
I think the first thing is that probably that the battle of ideas is never over and there's always shifts. And whereas I think I said previously that, you know, when I was a PhD student 20 years ago, Francis Fukuyama talked about the end of history, last man, liberal democracy had won. And now we see people listening to politicians on both sides of the Atlantic talking about more state control, for example. And I think that just highlights the fact that we need to keep pushing these ideas and keep trying to make it relevant to people and actually explain our arguments. I think also sometimes we can always be pessimistic about what we've achieved. So I remember when I was in the European Parliament, some of my friends on the left would say, "You've won the argument. You know, the EU's a liberal project." And I would say, "If only." I'd say, "Well, actually, I can see all sorts of intervention and protectionism for the EU. So I actually see it as more a protectionist project." So I think it's also how we see things, and we're self-critical, because have we achieved enough? Have we achieved that utopia, rather than making sure that our ideas are on the table?
If we look both sides of the Atlantic on sort of people's voting patterns. I mean, not that we're party political in any way here, but to try and work out what different demographics are sort of thinking of the world around them. It seems to be that sort of, or at least we're told, that virtually everybody under the age of 30 is voting for the closest thing to communism that they can find on the ballot paper. And the sort of disillusioned working class are increasingly voting for sort of populism and nationalism, you know, Trump, the Brexit Party or its former iteration as UKIP. And fewer and fewer groups seem to be sort of associated with classical liberal movements or classical liberal ideas. Particularly in regard to the young, do you think this is true? People are now sort of yearning for the hammer and sickle all over again because they can't remember how bad the Soviet Union was, or there's nothing to remember. They weren't born when the Soviet Union was around.
I think that's partly true. I mean, I remember when I was, I was born in the late 60s, and I remember in the early 70s, there were people around talking about the last war. And I'd think, well, that's a long time ago. Mm-hmm. But actually, it was only about 30 years before. Yeah, yeah. And I think we've reached that time when we talk about the dangers of nationalisation and, you know, the winter discontent and the Carter era in the United States. And people go, well, that was a long time ago. I don't remember any of that. Mm-hmm. So I think we do have to explain why some of the ideas of more state intervention are bad. But I think we have to be relevant. We have to make sure it's relevant. We have to explain why we believe in a freer society, why we believe in more liberalisation and more competition, not for the sake of it, but because it delivers better outcomes, delivers more jobs, delivers growth, it allows us to innovate. Those are the sort of things I think we have to explain, make it relevant and real.
But do you think that young people are increasingly attracted to more statist ideas, that the problems that they see in the world is that the state is not doing enough rather than it's doing too much and intervening too much?
I think there's certainly a lot of young people on campuses who think that it's a nice, simple solution. But I think also there are a lot of probably the silent sort of classical liberals or silent people, the silent critics of that view. And don't forget, there are lots of academics who will, most academics try to be fair, but there are some academics who don't hide their own feelings. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know, when people see problems, they want a solution. And they do see some sort of injustices or unfairness. And it's a very easy for those on the political left to blame capitalism and free markets. And I think we've got to show that how our solutions are relevant.
I think it was Churchill, wasn't it, who said that democracy is the worst system in the world apart from all the others, a kind of rather begrudging defence or support of democracy. Do you think there's people sort of feel that about capitalism now? That's the sort of what the median or mean voter or member of the public thinks. Well, I get that it seems we've tried everything. This is the only one that sort of basically functions. But I'm rather begrudging in my support of it. I definitely don't embrace it as a wonderful idea. It just seems to be the only system that sort of delivers, even though it's beset by problems. That seems to be, my sense is, the sort of mean, median, average opinion these days, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it probably is. I think that you probably get more support for some of our ideas when people have been through a bad political system, or live in a sort of under a left wing government or a socialist Marxist government. They realize how bad it is, and they go, actually, I want to look at some of these ideas. And I think those of us who've lived in generally a relatively freer society, we have the luxury sometimes, it's not a very nice word to use in that context, but of actually seeing what's wrong with our society and wondering how we tackle that. And actually, we're not very good at saying, we want a smaller state, but actually we want to tackle poverty. And we're not very good at saying there are lots of non-state solutions to poverty. So the left will accuse us, well, you may want to cut the state back, but that's because you don't care about the poor. Mm-hmm. And we have to demonstrate that there are alternatives to the state for tackling poverty. And also, for example, when a factory closes down in one factory town, I don't believe we should just simply be shouting out creative destruction. And, that sounds heartless. I think what we should be doing, and I don't know how we do this, is we go into these communities and we say, how do we help these people regenerate their own town? It's sad that the trade union movement has moved away from looking after workers to actually, trying to run the country. Because actually, I think that would have been a role of trade unions to help people who've just lost their job, get new jobs, retrain, maybe help them start businesses. And maybe that might increase trade union membership as well. I think that would be far more powerful. And I think we could be pushing these ideas.
Do you think the problem with a way that the classical liberal free market argument's been put is that it's got two underlying problems with that, I think. One is that it's kind of negative. I was looking through all of the articles I've written for newspapers, and they're nearly all why we shouldn't do something. Here's a proposal to do X, and there's me sort of whinging on about how this will never work and will sort of only make things worse. Much better to do nothing than to do this thing. So it's almost, you risk sometimes coming across as a bit of a nihilist in terms of analysing government policy. And the second is, it's sort of counterintuitive. Most arguments are about how you slice up the pie, not how you grow the pie. And if there are people at the top doing really well, can't we just take a bit of their pie and give it to the people at the bottom? Do you think we've got those fundamental problems in the way we communicate our case? And is there any way of getting round them, or is that just the nature of the sort of classical liberal philosophy?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I admire your self-awareness in terms of being negative, what we're against. I think we've got to start telling people what we're for, and actually why what we are proposing either solves some of their problems or actually is a better system. So, for example, one of my bugbears is that I think both the left and the right have failed the poor. The left will talk about more state intervention, more spending, but you'll go to some of these areas where a lot of taxpayers' money has been chucked at the problem and you still see poverty. I think, as Mike Tanner of the Cato Institute says, a lot of their effort is based on making poverty slightly better to live in, or alleviating poverty rather than taking people out of poverty. Mm-hmm. And I think we've got to start showing that we have solutions for taking people out of poverty that aren't necessarily the state. And I think we can also build consensus across the political spectrum on this, because there are, for example, cooperative socialists who believe that it doesn't have to be the state that tackles these problems. So I think we have to show people what we're for. Targets the NHS. Let's not come across as anti-NHS, because it sounds almost as if we're anti-healthcare. Let's talk about how actually we can have a better system of healthcare for everyone. What about the BBC, for example? Philip Booth at the IA has got some great ideas about looking at how you reform the BBC so it's not seen as a television tax mm-hmm. on people. Mm-hmm. I think there's some really good positive ideas. Let's start telling people what we're for.
But I think we've always had that problem with criticising institutions. Back in the day when the IEA had the temerity to suggest that perhaps the motor car industry should not actually be run by the government and it might actually be more efficiently run if it was run by the private sector, the sort of response was, what have you guys got against cars? Why are you so anti-car? It's ridiculous. Of course we need cars. And exactly, we get that as well if we're critical of the NHS structure. Why don't you want people to have healthcare? So I think it's difficult if you're actually criticising an institution to make it plain that you're being critical of the delivery mechanism, not the good or service itself.
But you could say what we're in favour of, what sort of healthcare system we want to see and why, and particularly, you know, why does this help the very worst off in society? So, but also I think sometimes these things do take time, but we've got to still keep banging the drum. You know, one of the papers that I think was incredibly prophetic was a paper in the 50s from the IA saying that in those days, that telephony or telecoms was run by a state monopoly that was part of the post office. It took 30 years for post offices or the old PTTs to split between post and telecoms to separate regulation and operation and to privatise. Now we have a competitive telecoms market. No one seriously suggests now that we should go back to a state-run monopoly by the post office running our telecom services. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, first of all, we've got to put the idea on the table. Some of them will take longer, but we've got to keep saying what we're for.
Sometimes we're accused a bit of being kind of, we always put the head over heart argument. You've mentioned a bit in your comments about we need to show that we actually care passionately about poverty relief. I mean, not just as a positioning or branding point, but because we do, because but we think that there are different mechanisms that would actually alleviate poverty and improve opportunity. But do you think folk on our side of the philosophical ledger tend to be guilty of this, that we give, you know, an absolutely rationalist approach to a particular problem? And somebody might, you know, what are you going to do about the poor? And you sort of say, well, if you look at the correlation between GDP per capita and blah, 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 then it would show X, Y, and Z. We're quite robotic and don't really often communicate empathy or humanity in our arguments.
Yeah, I mean, I think we fall into the same trap that we accuse the left of, which is top down. And so we kind of want sort of top-down classical liberalism. Mm-hmm. If you cut taxes, everyone will, you know, eventually be better off. We know that's true, but actually it sounds like, well, you've got to wait an awful long time for those tax cuts, you know, what the left accuses of trickling down. And I would like to see more sort of community-led or local-led initiatives, you know, local libertarianism, if you like. Mm-hmm. Actually, you know, so working with local communities tackling some of these issues. For example, in London, where I live, there are thousands of local community charities that are tackling the problem either because the state has failed or actually, you know, there is no state funding available. But they're not sitting back waiting for something. They're actually going out themselves, and actually going out tackling the problem. It could be helping ex-offenders. It could be setting up jobs clubs. It could be classes for migrants who can't speak English. Instead of complaining about it and waiting for the state to do something, people are solving the problem themselves. And we should be championing them.
So although it sort of fizzled out as a headline, you're telling me that David Cameron's Big Society is actually happening on the ground if you go and look at hard enough. Is that right?
I am. And one of my frustrations when I was a politician was that actually we did not think through Big Society enough and we didn't continue it. I thought it was a really, really good idea. And actually, the Labour Party at the time thought it was a good idea, but they called it the Good Society because it couldn't be called the Big Society. But people realise that outside the state, there are lots and lots of really good local charities and people and organisations that are tackling poverty and social exclusion right in their communities. And I think we should be championing them.
That's really interesting. But from a, if you like, from a public policy perspective, what are the barriers to there not being more of this? I mean, you know, we can point at things and say, hurrah. I mean, one of my criticisms or at least questions about the Big Society at the time was, okay, are we actually going to look at how we change policy to allow more of these initiatives to thrive? Or are we just giving a round of applause to the Rotary Club and the Cub Scouts? Are we just pointing at things and saying, isn't that nice? What do you think the actual policy barriers are in the way of there not being an even more thriving civil society tackling these problems?
Well, I think we need to go and talk to a lot of the local charities and let them tell us what their problems are. You know, what stops them growing? So, for example, I have spoken to organisations that have told me they're worried, for example, if they put on a local amateur dramatics for kids from deprived backgrounds, for example. Do they have to be, CRB checked? Do they have to actually have insurance? Do they have to adhere to rules about going up ladders for putting some of the stage set up? And sometimes it's perception, sometimes it's reality. You might remember a few years ago, there was a story that people stopped clearing the snow from the pavement in front of their house because they were worried that if someone slipped, they would be held liable.
And that was a myth.
That was a myth. Mm-hmm. And I think some of that, you know, it's not only what is the actual legal barrier, but mm-hmm. what's the perceived barrier. And I think we could be part of that revolution, if you like, of tackling some of those barriers, either calling for a change in government policy and arguing why it would allow more voluntary and more non-state solutions to poverty, or actually tackling the myth.
I was going to ask you a bit more about how you're going to go about your various tasks of overseeing the IEA's entire research operation over the coming weeks, months, years. Very often, I think the proposals and the policy papers from across the spectrum that grab the headlines are ones that have a kind of jaw-dropping, oh my God, number attached to them. To give you an indication, every year Oxfam release a report saying something along the lines, I can't remember the exact number now, but sort of the six richest men in the world have more wealth than the bottom 50% of the world's population combined. And that sort of generates huge headlines and a discussion about wealth inequality. We've obviously gone through in that particular case the statistic, and it's not that it's false, but it's hugely misleading. Half of the world's population are under the age of 30. And by and large, you don't expect people to accrue wealth before they turn 30 as a general rule. So even a relatively normally affluent middle-class person like me is probably richer than the bottom 20% of the world's population combined. But nevertheless, it was eye-catching. Do you think that the IA or other classical liberals should seek to go down that path? Or is there something intellectually dishonest about trying to pluck a number? And oftentimes also we at the IA are a bit sceptical about what economics can really forecast and whether you can really get things down to a decimal point. So we tend to shuffle in our seats a bit when we're asked, well, if you did this policy, you know, how much richer would it make the average household? And you sort of say, well, by some amount. How do you think we should communicate better? Do you agree with that, that it's sort of numbers that catch the attention, but that they aren't always wholly accurate and don't really tell the whole story?
I think that's part of also the sort of comms effort of any organisation. So I think that's good communications by Oxfam, by putting out that figure in other organisations. And I think we have to look at some of the things we believe in and see if there are similar numbers. So, for example, I know I'm reading our housing paper at the moment, and one of the things we say that actually there's a lot of greenbelt land that's actually walkable distance from a railway station. You wouldn't think of that as mm-hmm. greenbelt mm-hmm. land. People think of the greenbelt as rolling green fields of England, as it were. Mm-hmm. But actually, a lot of it's scrubland or industrial-type land. And if we could reclassify, for example, land that's close to a railway station, you're not distracting from the aesthetic beauty of the area. So, and then there are numbers. I think, like, if you allow people to build within 800 metres of a railway station, I think that would release land for about nearly 4 million homes, for example. Mm-hmm. So we could be doing similar figures like that to show the impact of some of the proposals of our policy. But I see the research here in a number of strands. The first strand, I think, is that we have to keep repeating the fundamentals of freedom, or economics 101. Why we believe in free market economics to a new generation, and maybe different ways of communicating that to different audiences, students, academics, the general public. I think the second thing is, I think I'm very open to the ideas of people just coming up with ideas, proposing ideas, because I don't think we should seek to centrally plan or pick winners of the next big idea. Let people come to us with ideas, and if it's an interesting idea, let's give them a platform to publish and have that debate. And I think the third one is, I think we have to be topical. What do people really care about? People care about housing at the moment. You know, what's our solution to housing? How does having less laws or freeing up the housing system create more homes and tackle some of the big problems we see in housing? What about the environment? We never seem to talk about, you know, whatever you think about climate change, we all want a cleaner environment. You know, why don't we talk about how, you know, more free market solutions will lead to a cleaner environment? And what about some of the new issues in terms of technology? Will blockchain, will that be used by governments to create a less free society? Or how can we create a freer society? What about things like AI? How will that change society? And what are the sort of things that we have to think about as people who believe in a freer society and less regulation about those issues? Mm-hmm. So let's be topical as well.
You've obviously very recently left the arena of elected politics. So you know how politicians think and speak. I think an irritation for me has been when I've been dealing with politicians who are on the face of it, or supposedly, or purport in private to be supporters of free markets. And then we might invite them to come along and share their views at the IEA. And very typically, they will begin any statement with, I'm a free marketeer, but... And then we'll have a whole list of market failures and end up pointing to a whole swathe of new state interventions and socialist sort of style actions that they support because they've identified a market failure in one area. Hardly any of them, there are some exceptions, begin their paragraphs with I'm a free marketeer because. Whereas on the, again, on the other side of the ledger, if you listen to people who claim to be supportive of socialism, I can't actually really remember a politician in recent years saying, I'm a socialist, but... they don't sort of say, I'm a socialist, but we have to accept that the market works best in a large number of cases, or socialism, when it's been tried, has failed in a huge number of areas. They seem to be on the because side, the expansion. Why is that?
I think it's because we have allowed people to character, our opponents to characterise us as uncaring. We have allowed classical liberals to be characterised as selfish individualism, as if we don't care about others, forgetting actually that we believe that man is a social animal and that we do care about our communities. We do care about a better life for our neighbours, our families, our friends, and our wider country. And we don't say that enough because we seem to talk about enlightened self-interest, and we allow that to be characterised as selfishness. Incidentally, talking about what some of our friends on the left say, I remember talking to a Tony Blair advisor, or a new Labour advisor, and he said one of the things we believed, that if you want socialism, you need capitalism to deliver it.
Right.
Or, you know, to deliver the money that we can then spend on all the things we want to. So they also have those discussions. I think we need to be talking more about the heart stuff and the things that people care about, so they no longer say, you know, I believe in free markets, but... But we should be saying, I believe in free markets because actually it takes more people out of poverty. I believe in free markets because, you know, it gives us more choice. I can afford things that I wasn't able to. Those sort of things I think we should be talking about.
So you've only been here a short while, but tell our listeners what they can expect to see from the IEA's research output over the coming weeks, months and years. How much better is it going to be in a year's time under your leadership?
I think infinitely better. starting from a very high base, of course. I want to see us people, you know, look, the issues that people are talking about, I want to see people thinking that the IEA is talking about those issues too. I want us to not only think, I want us to be part of a sort of a doing revolution. Let's just stop talking about stuff. Particularly my passion, which is tackling poverty in local communities without the state. I want us to be encouraging those local community charities, building a network of them, bringing in funders, mentors, and others to help incubate even more local community charities tackling poverty in their communities. I want us to be talking about the issues that people care about. What are our solutions about housing? What about the transport system? What about, you know, a better healthcare for all? What about all those sort of issues that people really care about? And then when things go wrong, do we have a solution? When a factory closes down, can we perhaps get a task force together and go in and help people? Or what do we say about alternatives when people lose their jobs? I think we have to show that we're relevant to the things that people really care about.
And do you think we're going to have a problem there with, I mean, I think you're right that we need to give more concrete examples, but so often our side of the argument is about the sort of unseen benefits of the free market. You know, in very many areas you can point to things that a state project or a taxpayer-funded project has delivered. You know, you can. I can remember all the arguments about whether the London Olympics was a waste of money, but the defenders of the London Olympics could at least sort of point to a stadium,
yeah,
and point to enhanced transport facilities, and then point to an actual sporting festival. Whereas I could just point to a number and say, "Yeah, well, I'm sure that money could have been used on other things that I'm not yet defining." You know. Do you think that's something we've got to be better at, actually pointing to good examples of the free market?
Definitely. We've got to point to good examples, and we've got to keep reminding people of good examples. So let's not take it for granted that people believe that actually the whole proliferation in telecoms, for example, and iPhones and Samsungs and others would have happened had there still been state monopolies of telecoms, for example. And I think we have to point to some of the successes, particularly in developing countries. One of the interesting things about mobile telephony, for example, was because the state controlled the old-fashioned PTTs, the state monopoly telecom services, they didn't see the threat from mobile telephony. And so they actually didn't regulate it early enough. So there was competition. Sometimes there was no regulation. And actually, you've seen how that helps many people in Africa out of poverty and give them information and access to the internet and all those sort of things. So I think we've got to do that. But at the same time, we've got to keep making the arguments, the fundamental arguments for about why we believe in free societies, classical liberalism. We've got to be getting into schools and universities as we do and do all that outreach. I don't think any of this is either or. I think we've got to look at, if I was a marketing man, I'd be saying, what are the different channels and what are the different products?
Well, Saeed, welcome again. It's great to have you on board at the IEA. We greatly look forward to hearing your voice much more often through a wide range of those channels in prosecuting the free market and classical liberal case in the weeks and months to come. Thanks very much for joining us for this episode of Live from Lord North Street. If you would like to subscribe and hear more podcasts from us, you can do so through Apple Podcasts. And for more films, blogs and podcasts, please go to www.iea.org.